Welcome, everybody, to Conversations That Matter. I'm your host, Alex Newman. We have a very special guest joining us today, Dr. Murray Sabrin. I'm sure you've seen his work. It's appeared in all kinds of different publications. He's a PhD. He's also the author of a new book, From Immigrant to Public Intellectual, An American Story. It actually tells the fascinating story of Dr. Sabrin, his career, his writings, his experience as a political candidate and a media influencer, and also the kind of intertwined with the story of libertarianism. His new book has been endorsed by the Honorable Andrew Napolitano and many others. And he is an emeritus professor of finance at Ramapo College of New Jersey. He's considered a public intellectual because he writes essays about the economy in both scholarly and popular publications. He's got a number of other publications under his belt, including Tax Free 2000, Why the Federal Reserve Sucks. We'll have to ask about that. Universal Medical Care from Conception to End of Life, and Navigating the Boom-Bust Cycle. His latest book before that, The Finance of Healthcare, was recently published, and his newest book, From Immigrant to Public Intellectual, An American Story, was just released. Dr. Sabrin, thank you for joining us. It's great to have you. Before we get into the details of the book and all that, just give us a little bit of your background. How did you get involved in libertarianism? How did you get involved in academic circles? And where did all this happen? Where did it come from?
Well, I think we can start in the 1960s when I was an undergraduate student at Hunter College in the Bronx. And I was a history major, geography minor. So obviously I was interested in current events and what occurred in the past that influenced us in the 1960s. And so I started reading Newsweek magazine as a way to keep up with current events. And in 1966, Henry Hazlitt's column was broken up into three economists, Milton Friedman, Paul Samuelson, and Henry Wallach. And I started reading them and started to get an understanding of the economy because inflation was starting to accelerate. The Great Society programs were kicking in. And Friedman was giving very cogent analysis of what was going on in the economy. And especially one essay caught my eye that I think was very influential in my thinking, where he said the minimum wage laws are racist because they price out of the market the least skilled individuals in our society who unfortunately tend to be in the inner city. And so that started getting me thinking about free markets and price controls. And then in 1969, after I graduated from college, I was in a Syracuse bookstore, of all places, after we were visiting my sister-in-law and brother-in-law in Utica, New York. And I came across this little booklet called Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal by Ayn Rand and other contributors. And that really got me going. A year out of college, the recession was underway. And all the articles there pointed to the counterproductive nature of big government. And so Alan Greenspan's essay on golden economic freedom started to get me thinking about the whole concept of banking and money and credit and the Great Depression. And he laid the blame of the Great Depression at the feet of the Federal Reserve for their easy money policies during the 1920s. And then fast forward to 2 years later, I read an essay in the New York Times Magazine by two Columbia University students about libertarianism. And I didn't know anything about libertarianism. I don't think I heard the word before. And he profiled a whole bunch of libertarians, including Murray Rothbard, whose essay I read on the way back from Europe in 1971 after Nixon did wage price controls in the New York Times op-ed, where he said the president is betraying his so-called free market principles by giving us wage price controls and severing the last link between the dollar and gold. And so that was really my big introduction to libertarianism. And I started reading more and more about it and eventually asked Professor Rothbard to be a member of my dissertation committee when I was at Rutgers. As an outside member, he was teaching in New York City at the time. And I became engrossed in the Austrian School of Economics and their free market approach to understanding how the economy works. And then intertwined that with libertarianism. And I basically became an Austro-libertarian analyst, if you will, in the early 1970s. So for the past 50 years, I've been applying these ideas, these concepts, to my writings in finance, economics, law occasionally. And I've just had a wonderful time explaining to my students, to the general public in essays and presentations in the New York metropolitan region and around the country about why libertarianism, which is not only the founding principle of America, but the way to have a sustainable prosperity, social harmony, and a peaceful foreign policy.
Yeah. And for those out there who are maybe new viewers, not regular followers of the New American magazine has a long history with the Austrian School of Economics. Ludwig von Mises actually used to sit on the editorial board of the predecessor publication to the New American magazine, American Opinion. And of course, Murray Rothbard has written or did write numerous articles for the New American magazine. So it's a small world in the Austrian school, but you know, I think time continues to prove that the Austrians have the best understanding of the way the boom and bust cycle works and the economy more broadly. Murray, I want to ask you kind of a tough question. Do you think libertarianism has a future in the United States? I mean, it just seems like it's been a one-directional freight train toward bigger and bigger and constantly bigger government. Libertarians always playing defense. Do you think there's hope for the ideals of liberty and the philosophy of libertarianism going forward?
Let me answer the question this way. I started teaching at Ramapo in 1985. If I were given a public lecture at the time and I said, in less than a decade, the Berlin Wall will come down, East Europe would be liberated, and the Soviet Union would be disintegrated. Everyone thought I had been smoking a lot of weed during the 1960s. But yet, every one of those things happened in just six short years after I started teaching in 1985, because the Soviet Union was involved in Afghanistan. They were printing money like crazy to pay for the war. The bodies were coming home. The mothers were upset. And it was so swift, the decline of the Soviet Union, that it was breathtaking to see the evil empire collapse before our eyes. And so the analogy I would make is, I don't know when the welfare warfare state in America will end, but I think it's coming sooner than later, because everything the Austrians and libertarian analysts have been talking about for decades is now coming true. We have endless wars. We have money printing constantly. We have an out-of-control federal government in terms of spending and regulation. And the question is, when will foreigners lose trust in the U.S. dollar? Because that's the key to this whole puzzle. When foreigners lose trust in the U.S. dollar, that's when the dollar will go down in value, prices will increase for foreign goods, and inflation will start to gallop away. And that's when we have the perfect storm. That's when the federal government will have to downsize, or we go into a runaway inflation as the Fed prints up money in order to balance the budget.
That sounds like fun, or not. you know, if you could wave a policy wand, Dr. Sabrin, and just, you know, where to start with this? What programs would you abolish? You know, you've written very extensively on the evils of the Federal Reserve. What would be a good starting point to reining in this out-of-control growth of government and, of course, the crazy monetary policy?
Yeah, that's a tough one, because there are so many vectors, if you will, of what to do. I would start by not having a having a non-interventionist foreign policy. That's really one of the keys to this whole puzzle, is that we're spending so much money on so-called defense when it's really nothing more than military expansionism around the world. So that would be one place. Of course, the Federal Reserve should not be manipulating interest rates and inflating the supply of money. And then, of course, the federal budget. We have to go through line by line, which I did in my 1995 book, Tax-Free 2000, of how to de-socialize the U.S. economy by phasing out all these major entitlement programs pretty quickly. And if we do so, that's when we reach a point that is similar to the founding of the nation. The founding of the nation was based on political independence. What I talk about in my 1995 book is financial independence, where there'll be no subsidies to corporations, to wealth, to higher institutions of learning, no entitlements to individuals, to families, to communities. In other words, we would have a true free market economy where we have a vibrant private sector and a vibrant nonprofit sector, and that would take care of all the needs of the American people instead of this welfare warfare state.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution.
What we need are just more people that would read the one we have.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable,
who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand when necessary.
Welcome back to Conversations That Matter. Alex Newman, your host here. Our guest is Dr. Murray Sabrin, and he's got a new book, From Immigrant to Public Intellectual, An American Story. Murray, Tell us a little bit about your book. What are some of the fascinating things that people are going to learn by reading it?
Well, I'm an immigrant like millions of others who came before me and who came after me. We arrived in America in August 1949 on a very hot summer day. My parents were the only ones in their families to survive the Holocaust in the native Poland. So we came here with my older brother, who was born during the war. And my father left Poland in 1946 with my mother and an older brother. My mother was pregnant with me when we arrived in West Germany. We stayed there for 3 years and came to America in 1949. So I was born in 1946. So 3 years, two and a half years, I was in West Germany as an infant. I don't have any recollection of that period of my life. And so I grew up in New York City, not far from Yankee Stadium, became a diehard Yankee fan when we moved to the Bronx in 1953. My father started working in a pencil factory for a dollar an hour, then went to a sheet metal factory for $3 an hour. We didn't consider ourselves poor. We just made ends meet. My father and mother saved money in order to provide for us for the future. Went through New York City schools, had the great opportunity of attending the Bronx High School of Science, one of the specialized high schools in New York City, and then decided to become a public school teacher. So I studied history, geography, and social studies education. Taught for 4 years, realized that this was not going to be my future, and went to Rutgers to get a PhD in economic geography and studied inflation, monetary policy, monetary history, financial history. And as I said before, Murray Rothbard was an outside member of my dissertation committee. And I just learned so much in that period from 1971, when I first was introduced to libertarianism, through the 1970s of writing my dissertation on inflation. And through circumstances, eventually got a job at Rampo College on a temporary basis in 1985, and that turned into a 35-year career teaching finance. And it was the most gratifying thing I can do, given my personality, given my desire to be an educator, teaching young people about basic financial principles. But in the last few years of my career, I taught financial history of the United States, which was as an interdisciplinary course as you can get. Not only did we study history, but we studied economics, finance, political science, sociology, philosophy. And students love the course because they learn things that they otherwise would not learn as an undergraduate business major. And students wrote me constantly telling me how what they learn is going to help them in their own business career. So it was a great career. And then since I retired in July of 2020, I've written 4 books in order to educate as many people as possible about healthcare, about the economy, about the boom bust cycle, about the Federal Reserve, and provide my autobiography as an inspiration to young people about the challenges that I face as a young person and as an adult. And it's really about perseverance, persistence, having a positive mental attitude, and sprinkled with a good bit of luck, you can get you can go a lot far in America.
Yeah, absolutely. You said something I want to drill down into a little bit, if you don't mind. You mentioned that you went to go teach in the public schools for a few years and decided that wasn't in your future. What was that experience like? What was it that caused you to say, not what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life?
Well, I started as a social studies teacher in the South Bronx, one of the poorest urban districts in the country. And in 1968, it was the year of the big teacher strike. There was a big battle between the teachers union and the Board of Education regarding decentralization. And it was a very chaotic year. As a first year school teacher, I was caught in between going on strike or not going on strike. And I stayed on strike because I was told very clearly that if I didn't strike, there could be repercussions. And since you are a first-year teacher with no tenure, I figured, let me go on strike and do what the administrators wanted, namely to have solidarity with the teachers. The administrators went in because they were not on strike. So anyway, after teaching a couple of years, and then there was an excess of social studies teachers. So I taught math for 3 years, and I realized this is not what I want to do with my life as a teacher, teach math, a subject that I was very good at, but not that I was interested in teaching. And so I got my master's degree in social studies education and spoke to my wife about becoming a college professor and getting a PhD. And that was probably one of the most important decisions of my life because of that, I was able to eventually get a teaching job that turned into a long-term career and eventually led to a publication of a book that was sort of the springboard to my gubernatorial campaign as the Libertarian Party candidate in 1997, which then morphed into becoming more in the public limelight as a spokesperson for libertarian ideas in New Jersey and other parts of the New York metropolitan area.
That's fascinating. And you've had some clashes with, I guess, elements of the establishment, if you will, some neocons and stuff. Any insight you can share on that?
Well, I think running as a candidate in New Jersey, mostly as a Republican, I ran as a Republican in 2000 and two other races for the U.S. Senate. And I can tell you the so-called party leaders are not interested in ideas. All they care about is getting cushy jobs in at the local level or at the state level. That's why the gubernatorial race is so important for political hacks in New Jersey, is because that's where the money is. They get all these contracts at the local level, at the state level, at the county level. And so they're not interested in philosophical ideas about what it takes to have a good society. And that was my insight as running as a candidate. That something you don't find in the textbooks is that they're not really interested in the grand ideas that will govern America. All they care about is, where will my next paycheck come and how can I lobby in order to get my clients what they want? So we have a lot of cronyism going on, not only in New Jersey, but the rest of the country. And of course, at the when you're running in, when I ran in 2008, after Bush gave us the endless wars in the Mideast, I said, I'm opposed to these endless wars. We shouldn't have these endless wars. This is not our battle. Let countries overseas decide their own fate and their own destiny and without us intervening. And so clearly the Republican establishment didn't want to hear that message because they were still tied into the Bush program of quote, creating democracy in Iraq and ousting Saddam Hussein. So I don't have much regard for the Republican establishment, given my own experience as a Republican candidate, that they don't care about downsizing the government. In fact, I have a quote from a student when I ran as a libertarian in 1997, when I gave my presentation at to a political science class at Rutgers, and I laid out what a libertarian New Jersey would look like. And after my talk, one student during the Q&A said, Dr. Sabrin, you say you believe in limited government, personal responsibility, and free enterprise. What makes you different than a Republican? I said, I mean it. And that is the... is the essence of the Republican Party today. They have done nothing to roll back the New Deal, the Great Society, the Bush interventions in the Mideast. They've basically gone along and played along with the Democrats. So in many ways, I blame the Republicans for what we have today as much as the Democrats, because the Democrats created these programs, but the Republicans never overturned them. And so that's why we're in the mess that we're in today. In fact, in 1971, I realized that we only have one party in Washington. It's the Washington Party. It's not the Democrats and Republicans. They're two wings of one big party. It's the Washington Party to make sure that the welfare warfare state keeps on growing.
Yep, the uni party, as it's known. Huh? Well, we're just about out of time, Murray, but I have to ask you this follow-up question. Party politics. You know, we have a Libertarian Party. It has won very few elections. What are your thoughts on party politics for activists out there who want to be involved in the political process? They actually do care about these ideas. What would your advice be? Stay involved in the Republican Party, join the Libertarian Party, forget party politics altogether?
Well, that's interesting because Michael Heiss with the Mises Caucus of the Libertarian Party has a project, Decentralization, which I think is fabulous because it really points out in order to change the hearts and minds of people, you start at the local level where you can meet one-on-one, school board elections, council elections, town elections. This is where a lot of people are concerned about what's going on in their own community. The big stuff at the presidential, it's very tough to break through it, even for a gubernatorial or a U.S. Senate candidate race. You may get involved in congressional races in order to move the needle, so to speak. But I would say just speak out. I mean, writing letters to the editor is a very good way of getting your voice known to a lot of people, writing op-eds. And as far as party politics, it really depends on what you like to do. I mean, some people prefer the Libertarian Party. Some people want to join the Republican Party and move the needle there. So it really depends on your own individual preference. I don't have any grand strategy as to what to do. I do what I do best, I think, which is to write articles and books about this and appear on podcasts like yours, Alex, and hopefully spread the message to millions of Americans in order to get the conversation going about what's the best way to have a free America.
Excellent. Dr. Sabrin, what's the best way to get your book? It's called From Immigrant to Public Intellectual, An American Story. Where should people order that?
Well, on Amazon. Amazon has the Kindle edition and the paperback, and the publisher priced it so low in order to have people not only buy one copy for themselves, but buy several copies and give out to neighbors, friends, relatives, colleagues, and let's have a discussion going all across the country about what does it mean to be have a free America? What does it mean to have a prosperous economy? What does it mean to have social harmony? What does it mean to have good relations around the world? And I provide answers for that in my autobiography.
Excellent. Dr. Murray Sabrin, thank you so much for joining us today. The book, one more time, folks, is From Immigrant to Public Intellectual, An American Story. I'm Alex Newman. This is Conversations That Matter. And Dr. Sabrin, you got something else?
Yeah, I also write on Substack, murraysabrin.substack.com, where people can follow me analyzing the economy and talking about the political events that are unfolding in America. So that's murraysabrin.substack.com.
MurraySabrin@Substack.com. And do you have any social media things? I guess you're on Twitter. Any other way for people to follow you?
At Facebook. I'll post on Facebook occasionally, get the word out about what I'm doing in terms of interviews. And so once I get the link for this interview, I'll send it around to LinkedIn and Twitter and Facebook.
Excellent. Dr. Sabrin, thank you so much. All right, folks, that's all we have time for today. I'm Alex Newman. This is Conversations That Matter for the New American Magazine. Until next time, God bless you all.